Could maybe explain our terms for the convenience, not like the animals, but that's probably enough to know.
Your premise is wrong, that's not what they were trying to do. Watson was Watson was attempting to demonstrate that what we call human emotions are subject to the same rules of classical conditioning as any other behavior. That's what they were attempting to prove. His theory suggested that every infant comes into this world with the capacity for three basic emotional responses: fear, love, and rage. What they attempted to do in that experiment was to demonstrate how to condition human emotions. Did it scar them for the rest of their lives? Depends on what you mean by the word scar and for the rest of their lives. The one child that it had the greatest impact on was a little boy by the name of Albert, whom you saw here. That wasn't his real name. The woman you later saw, Mary Carver Jones, one of my favorite women in the field of psychology, the history of psychology. She was one of the first clinical psychologists actually working in mental health clinics for children. She was working in a mental health clinic in Bethesda, Maryland, not far from Johns Hopkins University, when parents who were really upset about the behavior of their little boy brought him into the clinic for an evaluation. It appeared as though the boy had a rather significant and pronounced phobia, a persistent, irrational fear of animals, of fur coats, of hats with fur trim, of gloves with fur lining. Couldn't take him down the street past a pet shop if there were gerbils or rabbits in the window. Couldn't take him to the park because there were squirrels in the park, and he was terrified. When she interviewed the parents to determine when this problem first began, they suggested that it began not quite a year earlier. This child was now about 18 months of age. When asked what the precipitating cause might be, the only thing they could think of is at the time, the child's father was a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University. And while they were there at the school, there was an advertisement posted for parents to volunteer kids for a research study being conducted by John B. Watson. That was Watson you saw with the mask on. Albert was one of the subjects. As a result of that, the child, through something called stimulus generalization, generalized and developed a pervasive fear of people wearing Santa Claus masks, people with beards, coats with fur collars, etc. She set up the first counter-conditioning experiment and is really the person who invented behavior therapy. When we get there, we'll talk about it. He wasn't scarred for life. I do have grave doubts that he ever grew up and became the president of Friends of Animals, but at least he could function normally in his environment. So there can be lasting effects, and when it was said in the film that that experiment could not be done today, that is absolutely true. There's a part of your first chapter that talks about something that most students tend to overlook, and I nail them on the first test every time. The American Psychological Association puts forth a set of guidelines called Ethical Standards for the Providers of Psychological Services and Psychological Research that all psychologists have to adhere to. And those guidelines say that you cannot use a child, or an adult for that matter, in a psychological experiment if there is the potential for long-term detrimental or harmful effects on the subject. And your second question was? The same way it did to learn the multiplication tables and addition and subtraction problems on flashcards. It can be trained through reinforcement to respond to the correct set of numbers, whether it's the number of times that it taps or whether it's the numbers that it perceives visually on a flashcard. It's absolutely amazing what they can be conditioned to do. I want you to make sure that you have down in your notes everything that's on the board, because it is fair game. The reading assignment that was posted for you in my absence last Thursday was to proceed to chapter 4 and read the required portion of that chapter, not the chapter in its entirety, but the parts that you're responsible for. And those are the parts of the chapter that basically deal with elementary forms of learning, such as the ones you see on the board and the people who originated those. Before, hold on a second. Before proceeding with what we're going to talk about today to conclude what we discussed last night, these, by the way, are three biographical profiles of three very important people discussed in Chapter 4, people that you saw in the film. Let me call your attention to the second handout that I gave you, which says Study Guide Review Sheet Number 1, and then parentheses in small print, it says for Unit Test Number 1. That's not a threat, it's a promise. Gives you a brief overview of what we talked about in here in terms of the history of psychology, and it should call your attention to that handout I gave you called The History and Evolution of Psychology. Make sure you take a look at that. Here it gives you a brief synopsis. Here are important terms that you need to know and understand. That's on page 2, the bottom of page 2. It's continued on the top of page 3. Over here, the school. The early leaders or the people who originated the school you should list next. Over here, the main focus of the school, what it studied on. Go to the back page. Various research methods, their strengths and weaknesses. We've talked about several of these. We were, I believe, talking about the experimental method. We're going to finish that discussion. Please make sure you use this. Please take a look at the third handout I gave you. I had said to you a week ago that I was going to bring these materials in and make sure that you had them in your hands prior to the first test. That first test is now looming on the horizon next week. So I suggest you now take a look at the second handout. The people that you see on the board are on here. The terms that are important to what you were reading in Chapter 4. The types of reinforcement. Reinforcement schedules. The different types of conditioning. Classical, operant, instrumental. Please take a look at the beginning of page 3, at the top of the page, a comparison of classical and operant conditioning. Please note a list of the important terms and concepts related to these things that you are responsible for. Putting this stuff together as review material for you to use in preparation for your first test is fairly labor-intensive and it takes a lot of time. I certainly hope you put this material to good use. Some have described these handouts as life preservers once they took the first test, so you may want to give them sufficient attention so that you benefit from these handouts. Now, when you talk about certain types of conditioning, we have said that when we talked about Watson previously, we talked about his borrowing ideas from Pavlov to include as a basic model for his theory, and we talked about the use of terms like stimulus, response, and reinforcement. They mean exactly the same thing as the ABCs that Zimbardo talked about. Let me clarify. Antecedents, what comes before a behavior, sometimes referred to as the stimulus. B, behavior, or the response that stimulus evokes. C, consequences. Over there, it's referred to as reinforcement. C, So the ABCs of learning, as described by Zimbardo here, and as used by Skinner, are really stimulus, response, and reinforcement. Same meaning, just slightly different terms. And the purpose for that was to separate his ideas and his theory from the ones that came before it. Other questions, please. Before we go back to our experiment and talk about the redesign of the experiment we were discussing a week ago today. Any questions? Sir.
Techniques for the response of the dog in Pavlov's experiment, are those methods used for people?
Such as?
Per se, to quit smoking or to eat more, any problem that
We're going to get to that, but essentially what Pavlov did was to discover probably the most powerful means for the control and manipulation of all human and animal behavior. The answer to your question is yes, and they are extensively employed by our government. The United States government maintains 6 colleges of unconventional warfare in the United States. They are all based on the implementation of those principles. Only we like to be sophisticated and call it brainwashing. It's not brainwashing. It's using classical conditioning to shape behavior on the part of subjects. Sir?
They were talking about the CIA agoraphobia.
Yep, sometimes called social phobia, fear of public places, fear of going outside.
Well, I was wondering, like, to help you better understand, like, how to recondition someone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say someone had a fear of, like, performing in front of the crowd, like, maybe speaking, acting, doing anything in front of the crowd. How
right. People in ever-increasing numbers. People who have a fear of heights, they start them out by bringing in a stepladder and having them go up one step, then two. Talk about how they feel, talk them through it, have them come back down. Next time, they go 3 steps, okay? These are people who are afraid of heights, and people, for example, who won't go in airplanes because of the height. Kids who are afraid of school phobia children. First they get in the car, they go drive to the school, sit in front of the school to look at it, and they go home. Next couple of times, do the same thing, and then they get to the point where they take the child out of the car. They walk over to the front of the school, to the sidewalk that leads up to it. And they stand there and look at it, go back and get in the car. Next step is to take them to the foot of the steps. Now they're inside the schoolyard, but they're not going in the building yet. They're just at the foot of the stairs. It's a process called systematic desensitization, to give you the technical answer to the question you asked. And it's a process by which we desensitize people to those stimuli out there that they perceive as threatening or dangerous or fear-provoking. And that's what Mary Carver Jones invented, systematic desensitization. She took that little boy that the parents brought in, who was afraid of animals, and they had observation rooms in this particular clinic so that graduate students could observe people doing therapy with kids through one-way mirrors. There were 3 rooms in a row. If the light was out in that room over there, the people in this room couldn't see into it, but they could look, the people in that room could look in and watch what was going on. They put the lights on in all the rooms. They sat the little boy at a table in room number 1. After finding out what his favorite food was, chocolate ice cream, they brought him a huge bowl of chocolate ice cream, set it on the table in front of him, gave him a spoon and said, "Help yourself," and he started chowing down. And just as he did, in room number 3, 2 doors down, they carried in a white rabbit and set it on the table where he could see it. The kid freaked out. "No problem, we'll get rid of the rabbit." They also took away the ice cream. Next day, the same thing. Give him the ice cream, he starts eating. Gradually, over time, the kid got to the point where he could sit and eat the bowl of ice cream watching the rabbit 2 doors down in the 3rd room. Once he accomplished that, then they moved the rabbit to room number 2. A number of repeated presentations until he got comfortable with that. Finally, the child actually got to the point where he could sit at the table in room number 1, eating the chocolate ice cream with the damn rabbit on the table in the room, hopping around without freaking out. Systematic desensitization. The notion is something called reciprocal inhibition. We are incapable of entertaining two incompatible emotional responses at the same time. The pleasure from eating the ice cream and the fear that the rabbit produced could not coexist within the jug. When I worked many, many years ago, when I was in college as a lifeguard, one of the things that was one of the perks of lifeguarding was people would bring their kids for swimming lessons. Very often parents would bring me a kid who was terrified of water. The kid was so frightened that he wouldn't even go near the water. Once I learned about Mary Carver Jones, my life was made very simple. Thank God I was a psych major. I went over to the refreshment stand, said to the kid, "What's your favorite ice cream?" Kid says, "Strawberry." I'd get a double-dipped strawberry ice cream cone and say to the kid, "Would you like to eat this, or would you like to sit and watch me eat it?" "So I'd like to eat it." And I'd say, "Fine, now let me show you where I'm going to eat it." I'd sit him at the edge of the pool with his feet dangling in the water, and he'd get the ice cream. If he got out of the water or out of contact with the water, I ate the ice cream. It's amazing how much progress they made. No longer afraid of being in contact with water. It's called systematic desensitization. That's how they do it. Gradually desensitize the person to the fear-provoking stimulus.
All right, but what I was wondering is, the person who can't perform in front of a crowd, but he feels, he or she feels as though he loses some of his ability. Say they can do something, like say someone can sing really well.
You mean like an entertainer or an athlete?
Yeah, or athlete.
Okay.
Say in practice, they do it really well, but when they get in front of the crowd, it takes away from how good they are in practice.
Sir, I've coached sports for 23 years, and I've coached some of the finest practice players you've ever seen in your life. Put them in a game situation, and they choke.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Some people can overcome that, some can't. I had exceptional athletes play for me here when I coached the men's soccer team at this college. Fabulous athletes in practice. Put them in a game situation, and you'd think they were wearing the wrong color game uniform. Playing for the other team. I mean the most inept, incompetent. Hey, some people just aren't able to deal with, and this is another subject we're talking about, stress. Stress creates pressure which can inhibit a person's ability to execute what they know how to do and can do very well. That's a whole other question. That's not the same as somebody having to get up in front of a class in English 129, which is public speaking, and deliver a speech in front of a class where they are absolutely stressed out. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about people who become their own worst enemy when they are experiencing high levels of stress. It renders them incapable of functioning effectively. Something called a J-curve hypothesis. That simply means every person in this room has a different threshold at which they can tolerate stress and anxiety. And as you're building to that, their performance gets better and better and better. Once you hit that threshold, their performance level drops like a stone because you've now just passed their maximum tolerance for those uncomfortable emotions. And it varies from person to person. Maybe sometime we can talk about it outside of class, but that's essentially what it's about. Okay. Anybody have any questions on the film before we proceed? Okay. Here we go. Last time we had class, I think we talked about something called the co-twin method of study. And then I said we were going to talk about something called the modern experimental method in psychology, which I believe I indicated was essentially the brainchild of one man, John B. Watson. He's the guy who almost single-handedly invented it. Right? Have I lost anybody, or are you still with me? Is that in your notes? Okay. And then we talked about how we go about redesigning or reconstructing that experiment with two groups rather than one, right? We talked about the universe of potential subjects. We talked about the population and how we select the population. How do we select the population? Replica. But how do we select? By means of what selection process? The only reason why I ask is because it's on your next test, and I'd like to give you a leg up if I can. How do we do it?
You can't randomize it. You have to sit there and systematically go down a list and figure out exactly who...
Selection criteria. Okay? You select people based on whether or not they meet certain selection criteria so that they represent the larger group. That's how you get your population. You then take your population, and once you got it, through stratified random sampling, that's the second time I said it, and I said it a bunch of times last time, then what you have to do is to take that population and divide it into two groups, an experimental group and a control group. Then what? Okay. Let's put the emphasis on the positive. Okay? You're absolutely right. You just came at it through the other door. Here we are. We now have an experimental group and we have a control group. And what we do is the subjects who are exact, those two groups have to be identical. And then what we do is we introduce one new thing into the experimental group that isn't in the control group. That one new thing in the experimental group, that is the new method of teaching reading. Its counterpart in the control group is the old method of teaching reading. We teach both groups reading for an entire year after we test them in the fall, and then in June we test both groups again and compare the results to see, in fact, which method was better in terms of improvement in reading rate, reading comprehension, reading ability, etc., of the two groups. We said that it has to be a significant difference. Not a slight difference, a significant difference. So when we talk about an SD or significant difference, we're talking about 8 out of 10 kids in that group reading better. 80% of them. 75%. 90%. It has to be significant. It has to be something above 50%, and the higher it goes, the more significant it is. We also said that a study done like the one we described, using 500 children in a small community in Union County, is something called a pilot study. One that's run for the first time on a small scale. We tried to run it. We tried to eliminate any bugs, any glitches, any problematic situations related to the study. We then published the results, and we hope that people are going to attempt to replicate it. I think the other terms that I gave you were validity. Is it a valid study? Does it measure what it's supposed to? Reliability. When the study is repeated, do you get the same results or something very similar? And, of course, in order to do that, the study has to be repeatable. So that's replicability, replication. Okay, anybody have any questions? Yes, sir.
Why would the study not be repeatable?
Because people design it in a very peculiar way or a way that's specifically tailored to one group of people, but you couldn't use it in the general population. I can give you an example. There was a gentleman, beginning in about 1915, he started running a study. He was the man that introduced the whole field of intelligence testing in this country. His name was Lewis M. Terman. We're going to talk about him later on in the course. He designed a study, and he decided to test kids, select the kids that were the brightest that he tested, and follow them in a longitudinal study. And he checked out and studied through interviews, through observation, through questionnaires, through a variety of methods. He checked out their progress over the course of their lifetime. He followed those children who were preschoolers when he started, and when he died, somebody else stepped in. Followed them until they were in their 70s. Can you see anybody today deciding to duplicate that man's study and following a group of subjects who were preschoolers until they were 70? Man, that's your life's work. Now, that study cannot be repeated because of the way it was designed. It's flawed. It's not a repeatable study. Okay. Were we to the point where we were going to talk about the last method? Okay. What time is this class over? 20 after? Everybody got this down? last method we're going to discuss in class. Certainly not the last method, but the last one we're going to be talking about. The others you'll get from the handouts that I gave you or from the reading of the text. Originally known as the clinical method of research, today known as the clinical slash case study method of research, is unlike the other methods we have talked about. Survey, observation, experimentation. It is different in that this is the method of research, the only one that I'm talking about, which does not result in research data. What it results in is something called clinical evidence. Findings that can be highly suggestive of something, indicative of something, but do not provide conclusive research data, hard and fast data. And there's some reasons why. Clinical evidence. It can identify areas that should be studied through using some of the other methods, but it doesn't really prove or provide conclusive data, hard and fast data. That's important to know. Why? Well, we talked about studies where people conducted research with 500 subjects or 1,000 subjects or 1,500 subjects or whatever it is. This particular method of research is the method of research investigation that began with people in applied psychology rather than academic psychology. The primary purpose for their working with people is to provide service to people, not to study them. Any research information that is obtained is an incidental byproduct of their attempt to render help and assistance to their clients. Usually, the subject that's being studied or under investigation, and all of the people who do this kind of work are very meticulously trained observers. You go and sit down in the waiting room, and while you're sitting there, somebody hands you a clipboard with a questionnaire. So they use a survey method. They gather information about your background before you ever see them. When you go in and sit down face to face with this professional psychologist, they are going to conduct an interview. We've already talked about interviews. There's another method. Please note that all of this is the reason why this particular method is often called the hybrid method, because it represents a combination of techniques and methods developed in other research approaches, as well as some new ones that are unique to this approach. Research methods, techniques, interviewing, observing, combining a bunch of them. Now, there are some new techniques that this one developed, and I'll get to those probably not today, but probably next time. This is an outgrowth of the applied or professional psychologists in the field, not those who primarily do research. Their primary objective is to render assistance to people who are troubled, people who need assistance, people who have problems that need to be remediated. Their goal is to facilitate more healthy growth and development or more effective functioning of people. Okay? That's the primary objective, to render service, not necessarily to conduct research. This is what's important. We just finished, not 5 minutes ago, talking about a selection procedure for a population for a study. Here's what you need to know. The professionals, the psychologists, don't select the population that they study. The people that they study are self-selected. they pick up the phone and call and set up an appointment. They're referred by their family physician. They're referred by their minister or their pastor or their priest or their rabbi, their imam. They're sent there. Their employer says, we think you've been having some trouble related to the job and we think you really ought to talk to somebody. And they send them. So this is a self-selected population. Typically they come on a referral from somebody else or a self-referral. And I got to tell you, nobody gets up one morning and says, you know, my life has been incomplete. I've never been analyzed by a shrink. I think I'll call one today. Go in and spend a few thou to have the person put me through my paces and just see how tightly my head is screwed up. That's not what happens. That's like saying, getting up one morning and saying, hey, I've never had a root canal. I think I'll give it a try. This is a difficult, costly, and it's a painful, psychologically painful process for many people. So, these individuals are there for a reason. They are self-selected. And what I meant by what I just said is, these are not typical, average people. In some way, they are the exception to average. They have some kind of problem or difficulty, some issue that needs to be addressed, something that needs some kind of corrective intervention. Essentially, what these professional psychologists do can generally be described as planned intervention in the life of their patients. And when we talk about the people who are being studied, it's the patients who are in some way, shape, or form other than normal. They are different. Whether it be a learning difficulty or whether they're referred by the school guidance counselor and they're a child, whether they're having marital problems, whether they're having problems adjusting at work, whether they're having difficulty dealing with the stress of their job, whether they're having problems with a dysfunctional marriage, they're there for a reason. Therefore, you can't generalize what you learn from these individuals to the entire population. They're the exception rather than the rule. They're not your typical person. The methods that are used, observation, questionnaires, interviews, in fact, an ongoing series of interviews, but let me clarify this right now. The last time we talked about interviews as a technique, we talked about something called structured interviews. Please note, these interviews are called clinical interviews. Clinical interviews, meaning that the direction of the interview is determined by the person who's being interviewed, not by the interviewer. You don't go in and give somebody a litany of questions asked in a particular order. It's not an interrogation. The client decides what it is they need to talk about. What brought you here today? What, if anything, have you tried to do about it, and how has it worked? Who referred you? Oh, what did they hope would happen as a result of your coming here? So please note, these interviews are highly subjective. It's what the person feels they have a need to talk about and express and clarify. What issues need to be resolved in their life. Anybody have any questions? There's more to this than we've gotten to, but does anybody have any questions on what I've just said to you? The next thing we're going to get into next time is one of the unique original contributions by people who do this kind of work, and that's the use of psychological testing. That's it for today. We will see you next time.